And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when there's all kinds of confusion and contradiction and dispute regarding various public opinion polls and what they're actually finding. There's a big article in the Daily Beast about how public opinion polling and the observations of a bunch of political observers, some of them Republicans, indicate that there is a Biden bounce going on. Is that true? Is he, at his tender age of 81, able to bounce? Or is this just wishful thinking? We will get to that on the Michael Medved Show. There is also all kinds of contradictory information about the state of religion in the United States, with people talking about churning, that the most active aspect of religious change in this country is not people abandoning religions, but people switching religions. There are probably people listening to me right now who have at some point in your life gone from one faith tradition to another. Is that necessarily an unhealthy thing? We'll talk about it right here on the Michael Medved Show. We will also talk about contradictory polling regarding the Middle East. The Gallup poll is just out with a piece that said the majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's military actions in Gaza, which is actually not surprising considering the extremely biased press coverage of Gaza. One of the things that gets me, and it's one of the things I talk about with my wife, because every time she sees it, she's disappointed. The thing you hear over and over and over again is 32,000 innocent Gazans have been killed. And they no longer, when they give that number, give you any information about its source. Who says 32,000 have been killed? It's Hamas. That is their statistic from the Hamas health ministry. In any event, there are contradictory polls by Gallup. And then on the other hand, on the part of the Pew Research Center. And because of the way the questions are asked, I would go with the Pew Research Center. President Biden has won, I guess, a little victory. This is not political, but, well, yes, it is political because it's really based on him trying to keep his fractured Democratic Party together on this issue of Israel. Today, Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel reversed himself and planned to send two top Israeli officials to Washington as early as next week for talks about a possible military operation in Rafah. This, according to U.S. and Israeli officials. In other words, when the United States abstained and did not veto that U.N. resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire without a condition of first having to release those hostages, and this coming at a time when the very first of the hostages who has been released previously actually has now testified and worked with the New York Times on an incredibly horrifying account of what she was subjected to, which is rape, and that's just the beginning of it. Rape, torture, abuse during the months that she was held hostage, and for no crime. She's not a prisoner. She wasn't arrested for anything. She was living in Sderot with her family, and she was kidnapped on October 7th. And now she is in the United States. She's back in Israel, actually, talking about what really happened and putting this in context. There's a terrific piece in the Wall Street Journal by a great French thinker and scholar, Bernard-Henri Lévy, who has written before. He was a leading anti-communist voice in France at a time when the left wing was very much in control in France in a way that it isn't anymore. But in any event, Bernard-Henri Lévy talks about what would happen if Israel does what the Biden administration apparently wants them to do, which is to call off finishing the job against Hamas, and leaves them standing with four active battalions sheltered with their human shields and about a million of them in Rafah. We will get to that on the Michael Medved Show. And this confusion about what the American people think. The most interesting thing to me about all of this contradictory polling that I mentioned is that the Pew Research poll, which is a big one, they interviewed 12,000 different people across this country in what was attempted to be a representative sample. And yes, the majority of people thought that Israel had gone to war for valid reasons, and that's the language they used in the poll. But what's amazing is that there were a third of Americans, it's a minority, but still it's a big minority, a third of people in this country thought that the reasons that Israel went to war were not valid. Can you think about that for a minute? Just think about it. There are people out there that don't think it's valid to go to war if you've been invaded. If there are at least 5,000 armed terrorists who cross the border, breach the border, come into your country, murder 1,200 people, most of whom are civilians, great majority of whom are civilians, murder them because they burst into your country and then proclaim that, yes, they're just achieving their goal, which they have always upheld, and that's what Hamas is, the goal being to destroy the Jewish state, the only Jewish state in the world. Okay, with that happening, how is it not a valid reason to go to war? What possible reason could be more valid? Was it valid for us to go to war against the Japanese after they attacked Pearl Harbor, killed 3,000 Americans? And they didn't kill civilians. They aimed their attack not at grandmothers and grandchildren and babies and beheadings and the awfulness. They did a bombing attack. It was horrible. There are 3,000 Americans killed. And was there any question at all that it was valid for the U.S. to go to war once we've been invaded? I mean, seriously, think about this for a moment. The idea that there are, what do you do if you don't strike back? We'll get to the speculation by Bernard-Henri Lévy about what it would mean for the world, what it would mean for the U.S., what it would mean for the Western Alliance if Biden succeeds in what apparently his administration is trying to do, which is to get Israel to call off the invasion of Rafah. The last stronghold where the Hamas leaders are actually holed up. And Lévy has a different idea. We'll get to that idea and much more coming up on The Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
Integrity, integrity, integrity.
This is The Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
The report today here on the Michael Medved show that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has changed his mind. He is planning to send two top Israeli officials to Washington as early as next week for talks about a possible military operation in Rafah. That according to officials by the U.S. and Israel. Why it matters, Axios asks. It's a sharp reversal by Netanyahu, who on Monday canceled the same trip by the same people in protest over the U.S. abstaining on a U.N. Security Council resolution that called for a ceasefire in Gaza without demanding, as a precondition of the ceasefire, releasing of the hostages. It is unbelievable. Think about it. It's October 7th. These people have been held prisoner in appalling conditions with torture and sexual violence and misery against them. Some have died, but they've been held since October 7th by Hamas. And you want a ceasefire without agreeing to release the prisoners? What does it cost Hamas to release the prisoners? And when you say prisoners, that's really the wrong term. They're hostages. Because when you're talking about prisoners, the people they want Israel to release in return are in fact prisoners. They're people who are convicted of terrorism. They're people who perpetrated terrorism. But the fallout over the canceled trip, and this again is from Axios, and a deadlock in hostage talks added to already spiraling relations between Netanyahu and the Biden administration. There's an extremely persuasive piece in the New York Times about how both Biden and Netanyahu are motivated by politics. They're not motivated by any substantive difference between Israel and the United States, but politics can do tremendous damage. When you're talking about issues of war and peace, when you're talking about issues of national survival, the Prime Minister's office has agreed to reschedule the meeting dedicated to Rafah, said the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre today, this morning, adding that the discussions about Rafah are urgent. We are now working on a convenient date that will work for both sides, she said. Netanyahu is expected to send his very close confidants, the Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, who's a personal friend, and he's a friend of my family. Okay, he's the former U.S. ambassador from Israel to the United States. He's also originally a Floridian. They will also be sending the National Security Advisor, Tsachi Hanegbi, who is one of those centrist and moderate conservatives in the Netanyahu administration. He's not one of the real hardliners. Netanyahu's said the prime minister hadn't approved the delegation's departure, but didn't deny discussions are being held about scheduling it. A U.S. official said that canceling the trip and the rhetoric around it was an unnecessary drama on Netanyahu's part. A senior Israeli official agreed, said, Bibi made a mistake. Okay, now he's fixing the mistake, but what about the much deeper and more dire mistake that Joe Biden is making? I mentioned Bernard-Henri Lévy, who has a piece in the Wall Street Journal. And he asks a provocative question. He says, let's imagine that Israel yields to the pressure pushed by an American president already under fire from a segment of his party that objects to his support for a, quote, genocidal state. Israel refrains from entering the city of Rafah to finish off Hamas's four surviving battalions of an original 26. The others have been destroyed. Israel agrees to the general ceasefire of undetermined duration that the U.S. administration seems to push amid increasingly virulent anti-Semitism. So the supposition that the U.S. pushes Israel into the capitulating isn't implausible. It is the path forward that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who styles himself the Jewish state's shomer or protector, has chosen. It isn't hard to picture an Israel that is sermonized, impeded, and prevented from dealing with Hamas the way the U.S. dealt with Al-Qaeda and ISIS just a few years back, and Israel forced into defeat. If that came to pass, what would happen? That's the question. Hamas would declare victory on the verge of defeat, then the next minute revived. These criminals against humanity would emerge from their tunnels triumphant after playing with the lives not only of the 250 Israelis originally captured on October 7th, but also of their own citizens, who they transformed into human shields. The Arab street would view Hamas terrorists as resistance fighters. In Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, nations that signed the Abraham Accords or were leaning towards doing so, Hamas's prestige would be enhanced. In the West Bank, as in Gaza, Hamas would quickly eclipse the corrupt and inefficient Palestinian Authority, whose image would pale next to the twin aura of martyrdom and endurance in which Hamas would cloak itself. Isn't that obvious that he's right? That that is what would happen? It would be handing victory to some of the most evil people in the world? Hamas would be the law in the Palestinian territories. It would set Palestinians, it would set the ideological and practical agenda, regardless of the formal structure of any new government. And Israel will never deal with a Palestinian authority of which Hamas is a significant part. Goodbye, Palestinian state. Hope for peace, harbored by moderates on both sides, will be dead. This is why the world has one choice. Instead of putting all their energy into trying to get Israel to bend, leaders should push Hamas to surrender. The Biden administration should redirect the time it is spending in useless negotiations with the Qataris, experts in double dealing, to calling the Qataris bluff by demanding that they push the political leaders of Hamas, whom they host and protect, to live up to their responsibilities. There is more about how that idea, not pushing Israel to surrender, but pushing the losing side here, the Hamas side, to surrender, is the only way to go. We'll get to that and more coming up on the Medved Show.
You're listening to the Mighty Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there is a very important tweet that just came out from one of America's leading foreign policy thinkers. In fact, maybe America's leading foreign policy thinker, period, who would make a wonderful Secretary of State and even at one point had dreams of running for president of the United States. I'm talking about John Bolton, who has been a former ambassador to the UN, a former national security advisor to President Trump. President Trump, if he wins, should certainly bring John Bolton back into the government and the foreign policy establishment. Anyway, Ambassador Bolton just wrote on Twitter, X, he said, Israel's attack on Hamas in Rafah could come at any moment. And victory there could be a decisive turning point in the struggle against the ultimate aggressor, Iran. This is not the time for the United States to show weakness, especially at the UN. Jerusalem is following Winston Churchill's insight. Without victory, there is no survival. Washington should follow suit. Also, he decided not to quote Douglas MacArthur, said very simply, there is no substitute for victory. And back to finish this extraordinary piece by Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is the author of The Will to See, Dispatches from a World of Misery and Hope. He's the author and director of the documentary Slava Ukraini, which means glory to the Ukraine. In any event, he finishes talking about why it would be such a disaster. It would hand the defeated and murderous Hamas regime a victory they never earned. It would just be handing it to them, because they would claim, look at that, we got Washington to prevent the Israelis from doing what they can do and will do, and I am confident they will, which is to go after the remaining battalions in their tunnels. And not only destroy the tunnels, but destroy that military capacity to repeat October 7th again and again and again and again. Like a Kafkaesque nightmare. In any event, Bernard-Henri Lévy concludes, those who portray themselves as praying for the end of this war and praying for a negotiated peace on the day after must recognize there is only one path to that end. First, the release of all hostages. There are 134 of them left, including five American citizens. They should all be released. Of course they should be released. Second, the evacuation of civilians from the zone of imminent combat. When will the world recognize that Israel, having been forced into this war, is doing more than any army ever did to prevent civilian deaths? And finally, in Rafah itself, the destruction of what remains of Hamas and its death squads. Without this military victory, the endless wheel of misfortune will begin to spin yet again, though faster. This is the terrible truth. And he is so pointedly correct that with all of that, it's amazing to take a look at another report from the front. This from the front of American Public Opinion. There's a new Gallup poll that to some extent contradicts a larger and I think more serious poll by Pew Research Center. But the Gallup poll says a majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's military actions in Gaza. Of course they do. All they hear about is they don't hear about the death of terrorists. They don't hear about the erasure of some of the commanders who are responsible for the horrible crimes against humanity of October 7th. What they hear about is innocent civilians and children. And so a majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's military actions in Gaza in a stark shift since last fall, according to a Gallup poll released just hours ago. Why it matters? The new findings come as Israel prepares for a controversial ground invasion of Rafah. Tensions have grown between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as the humanitarian toll of Israel's war has mounted. Driving the news, 55% of Americans disapprove of Israel's military response in Gaza, a 10 percentage point increase since November, according to the new poll. About 1 in 3 Americans, 36%, approve of Israel's military actions in Gaza, according to the new poll. That's down from the aftermath of Hamas's October 7th attack, when a November poll found that half of Americans approved of Israel's actions. What I find extraordinary is this, is even in November, right after the October 7th massacre, half of Americans disapproved of Israel going in to wipe these bastards out and to prevent their sworn intention of repeating October 7th again and again and again, because they wasted no time and saying, doesn't matter, they're coming after us. They're going to kill a lot of the terrorists, but we'll be back. More terror. And then there is this. Among Republicans, the percentage who approve of Israel's actions has dropped from 71% in November to 64% now in March. Okay, that's not a colossal drop. And it does show you how much more clearly Republicans see the world and see what is going on in the Middle East in particular than do some others. I mentioned that this was contradictory to the Pew Research survey that was released 3 days ago. And they open the piece. The headline says, majority in U.S. says Israel has valid reasons for fighting. Thank you. Well, of course they have valid reasons for fighting. Fewer say the same about Hamas. Months into the Israel-Hamas war, roughly 6 in 10 Americans, 58%, say Israel's reasons for fighting Hamas are valid. Okay, that's very reassuring and it's very encouraging. But when it comes to the people who think they are not valid, it ends up being 15%, and with 26% unsure. So you have a third of Americans who don't think that Israel, after being attacked the way it was, after that attack, there's still people who question, quote, valid reasons for fighting. There are religious differences in terms of how people see this. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about, well, religious differences in general and why the most successful denomination for keeping people in church could be a little surprise for many people. We'll be right back on the Medved Show.
Your outlet for outrage.
Where's the outrage? I'm shook up, and you know what's going to happen? I'm going to be driving down the road listening to all this. I'm going to wreck the car and sue Michael Medved.
Okay, don't sue and don't wreck the car.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, the story from the Gallup poll, which did a Gallup poll about religious observance. They do this every year. And what they pointed out is that for most U.S. religious groups, attendance at religious services of any kind have gone down and have gone down dramatically. It is now a situation where only 3 in 10 U.S. adults, so a distinct minority, not a tiny minority, but a minority, attend religious services regularly. And that includes religious services, people who attend once a month, almost all the time, or once a week. It basically gives you broad latitude, but 70% don't go regularly at all to religious services. And as Americans observe Ramadan and prepare to celebrate Easter and Passover coming up, the percentage of adults who report regularly attending religious services remains low. 3 in 10 Americans say they attend those services every week or almost every week. That's 21% who go every week and 9% who go almost every week. While 11% report attending about once a month, 56% said they seldom go to religious services, and 25% say never. Actually, it's now up to 31% who say they never attend. By the way, I think that if anything, this overstates the number of people who attend, because there's a tendency with a poll like this, when you ask, well, how often do you go? Do you go every week? Do you go every month? There's not as many people who say they sometimes go, because if people say they sometimes go, it probably means once a year. And I think that that never attending 31% is probably a little bit overstated, because people still think it sounds good to say that I know something about it, or I dip my toe into it, or something of that nature. There's also NPR, which reports on another poll about religion and religious involvement. This one from the Public Religion Research Institute, which is a pro-religious lobbying organization, really is what it is. But they report people in the U.S. are leaving and switching faith traditions in large numbers. This idea of religious churning is very common in America. According to a new survey, it finds that around one quarter of Americans, 26%, now identify as religiously unaffiliated, a number that has risen over the last decade and is now the largest single religious group in the U.S. Isn't that amazing? Largest religious group in the U.S. is not Catholics, not Protestants, not Jewish people, not Muslims, not Hindus. It's people who say, I'm nothing, none. I'm not religiously affiliated. I'm part of what's called the nuns, because you have no religious preference. That's similar to what other surveys and polls have found, including Pew Research, they point out. PRRI, the Public Religious Research Institute, found that the number of those who describe themselves as nothing in particular has held steady since 2013. But those who identify as atheists have doubled, from 2% to 4%. And those who say they are agnostic has more than doubled, from 2% to 5%. Okay, those numbers are still indicative of the fact that religion is alive and well in America. And this whole idea of religious churning, of people going from one faith to another, I actually believe that's one of the reasons that the United States is more religiously minded than other wealthy Western countries. In other words, if you compare the United States to Britain, our statistics, which you just went over, that about a third of people go to church regularly here in the United States, in England that number is below 10%. And you have these beautiful cathedrals, some of the most beautiful buildings in the world, that are empty all the time. There are very few European countries where religion is alive and well and flourishing, even to the extent it is here in the United States. And for instance, Poland is, having visited Poland, the churches are crowded on Sundays. And people, and I think partially it's because religion, particularly the Catholic religion, was so suppressed by the evil communist governments that prevailed in Poland for a half century, that that basically there was a pent-up religious feeling and a desire to draw closer to tradition. The basic advantage that America has is that there isn't one faith, that it's a competitive marketplace, that people do switch. And you go back to all of those awakenings that have really created the country. We had the first Great Awakening, which was in the colonial period, right before the Revolution. The second Great Awakening, which actually started in the 1830s, was one that produced the abolition movement and the movement against slavery. But all of these various Great Awakenings had new religious organizations. And by the way, one of those new religious organizations that began in the 1830s and 40s was Mormonism. And with all of these numbers about people who attend religious services regularly, Mormons, 67% go regularly. And it's one of those things that Mormons have always understood, that participating in the marketplace in a competitive drive to get people involved. And when you are a religion that asks things of people, Mormons, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, are required to tithe, to give 10% of their income basically to the church and to the church's various good works. For raising kids, just like Americans used to be expected to go to the army, Mormon young men and young women, though it's less strict for young women, but they go on mission trips. And this was the Book of Mormon, big hit on Broadway, was about that. Mitt Romney, he did a mission trip in a place that was very hard to turn people religious, Paris. He was there. But Mormons ask that of you. And it's a religious tradition that asks of a family to reserve one night a week, which is family night, where, you don't go to a social event, you don't go to cheerleading practice, you don't go out to a movie. You have one night where you spend time at home with your family. And it's something that I think a lot of people think that the way to grow a religious faith is to make as few demands as possible. I actually think that what you can see happening, and this is also true in the Jewish world, is the most vital and rapidly growing segment of the Jewish population is the religious segment, is the segment that would describe itself as Orthodox or traditional, where, again, the commitment of what is asked of you, chosen for responsibility, not for privilege. Speaking of responsibility and not for privilege, you have a privilege right now, which is our special super spring sale. 50% off on either of our MedHead membership plans. The first one, the core membership to MedHeads, it's 50% off down to what comes to $250 a month. This is for first-year subscribers. Or you can get a MedHead Plus membership. And again, it's down to about $5 a month. And that one gives you access to everything in our MedVed History Store whenever you want to download it. And to get a deeper appreciation for this greatest nation on God's green earth.